Welcome once again to the Johnny Fallon Podcast Referendum Series, where we are taking a look at some of the most important referendums in Ireland's modern history, how they have affected the issues and indeed the population, how some of the great social and political issues of our time have been solved by the people or sometimes created further issues along the way. We'll be looking at all of the referendums right up to recent times, and this week we're going to be looking at the Good Friday Agreement and one of the most resounding referendum results. Why was it so resounding? What was behind it? And what drove the agreement in the first place? So sit back and let's take a little journey back in time and see what was it about the Good Friday Agreement that had everybody in such agreement at the time. Well, it's great to be back with another episode in our referendum series. And in particular, this week, a little bit of an unusual one. We're going to take a look at what was the Good Friday Agreement, or to some, the Belfast Agreement referendum, which, of course, took place in both Northern Ireland and in the Republic of Ireland, in order to, I suppose, really cement and create a culmination or as might be more accurate, an ongoing leap in the peace process in Northern Ireland. And I guess it's an interesting one because so much of what's happened in very recent years, when we talk about Brexit, trade, we've talked about borders, all of that kind of thing, people are hearing more and more about, well, it's the Good Friday Agreement, and does it breach the Good Friday Agreement, and all of that debate. And it's so important, I suppose, that we understand just how important the referendum itself was within that, because I could devote a whole episode, and maybe I will at some point, to some of the major steps in the Northern Ireland peace process. How the Good Friday Agreement came about itself could be a very long, maybe even a couple of episodes in itself. So we're not going to cover so much of the agreement and how it was reached in this particular podcast, because I just want to give you a flavour of the referendum itself and what happened in it and what people's views were in relation to that referendum, and maybe just what give you a sense of the mood that went with it. Because one of the things I think is so difficult in our modern age is when we talk about things like Brexit now, and we talk about the issues or problems that are being faced in Northern Ireland, for many of us, there is a gap, a really big gap. And I think particularly anybody that doesn't remember the Troubles in Northern Ireland, it seems like another world and lifetime away, and something that didn't really impact people in the same way. It's you know, a horrific thing from a past, but it was a bygone age, and we're safe from that. And we always get very comfortable in that. And I think therefore it's important to give that sense of how recent this really is, and why it was important, and why there was this outpouring of support and need for it, and just how vital it was in Northern Ireland at that time. And indeed, what a step it was in the Republic. So that's what we want to do today. Give that little bit of an understanding to the Good Friday referendum and the context it lands in. The result is no secret. The campaign itself was not exactly one that had a huge amount of fiery moments or anything in it, although there was some strong debate within it. But it is important to put this one in context, and that's why I think it deserves its own podcast and on this occasion that we look at it, particularly in terms of the threats that are now there for the Good Friday Agreement and why those threats, we need to be careful about them, and we need to think about these things, and we need to appreciate that when these referendums happened and were supported, this really did mean something to people, and for a very, very good reason. So let's just for a moment think about Northern Ireland, how it got to that point. And I want to stress here, this is not an in-depth history. We're going to go back because, well, it's one of the biggest, most complex topics you could possibly approach. So I'm not giving a history here. It's more to give a sense of the culmination of something and why that culmination was important. Because Northern Ireland is filled with history. It's filled with feeling. It's filled with misunderstood history sometimes. It's filled with spin. It's been filled with arguments from that have been going on for centuries. And it is fueled by a huge amount of hurt on all sides and a huge amount of belief on all sides. It was one of the most passionate conflicts, I think, that you would find anywhere in the world in terms of the deep divide that it created for centuries. But to really give you that whistle stop, for those of you maybe who aren't familiar with perhaps Ireland or Northern Ireland, and there are some of our listeners who maybe aren't quite as au fait with that. So let's put it in context. I mean, Ireland, when you come to a situation like this, is a country that has such a deep affinity with its history. And like most European countries, that then tends to go back not just for, you know, a few decades or a couple of hundred years, but thousands of years. And things are still being discussed. You get this sense that the Good Friday Agreement comes about peace, and there was a lot of talk and a lot of symbolism at the time that this was the first time the island was going to fall silent in 800 years, that it was the first time that we were going to see true peace, maybe lasting peace on the island. Now, all of that might have technicalities and people saying, oh, it was okay at this time and that decade and this time, but there was a sense that this was the ultimate culmination of a very, very long and arduous journey. Now, for others, it was only a step on the way. People used to want reunification and all that. And others, it was an agreement that allowed people live in peace, finally. But you have to go all the way back to understand that the amount of baggage that was brought to the table when dealing with Northern Ireland. It was enormous. I mean, you're going right back to a time when, you know, the Norman invasion and then this feeling that, well, the Normans have come into Ireland and in this invasion, they're invited in by a Leinster king and then, you know, they take over. But it kind of isn't so bad because there's this thing, the Normans become more Irish than the Irish themselves. But there's still a sense that Ireland isn't its own anymore once that happens. And you go through, I mean, we're talking about the 1200s, 1300s, 1400s, all those years. It's that long ago that you're looking at these kind of debates kicking off and people talking and debating about issues in Northern Ireland as if these things are still really particularly relevant. You have the Orange Order in Northern Ireland, who, you know, their marches create all of this problem, and these marches are there to commemorate William of Orange. You know, these are centuries old feelings, and people trace back their political allegiance to centuries old conflicts. And you have, you know, so you get this. And there were huge crimes being committed in these years, and people still remember them. They remember, you know, the problems, either whether you were Protestant or Catholic, and on both sides in these wars, atrocities were committed. But you're going back into that. You're going back into a time when Oliver Cromwell comes to Ireland, and there's this argument about, is what he does when Oliver Cromwell comes to Ireland genocide or not? And all I can ever think when I'm reading that is, you know the old argument of if you're defending, you're losing. If you're debating whether or not your actions were genocide, I think you're losing. Because you should never be in that zone. No human being should ever be in a zone where they have to say whether or not what they did was genocide. But it certainly felt that way to anybody who was Irish. There were horrific atrocities committed and an attempt to push the Irish Catholics completely off their land right throughout the island of Ireland. That's the kind of conflict. These things still inform people. They still get people riled up, and they still get people. There's wounds that are that deep. You go through from when you get beyond Cromwell, you're going into the stages of you know, all of the challenges that were there. All of landlords coming in, people being thrown off their land. You get into these penal laws where Catholics couldn't own land, where if one member of the family decided that they were to become Protestant, they would inherit everything. An attempt to eradicate, if you like, the Catholic religion completely. And these issues really, really still affect people. And they were affecting people when it comes to their songs, their traditions on all sides. They were still very much part of what they saw as they needed revenge for. They needed to, there could be no forgiveness for. All of those debates were still very much carried by those who were fighting on either side. And you go carry that right up through the famine, and you get all of this sense that, you know, again, you get I watched a documentary on the famine, which was quite brilliant recently, but it was, you know, again, it has some legal experts then arguing, well, does what happened in the famine constitute genocide technically or not? And again, if you're in a position where you're debating whether or not your actions were genocide, I think you're onto a loser. But that's the level of hurt. And you bring that right up to revolutions. And the Irish have this thing of a revolution in every generation. This isn't easy stuff to get out of your national psyche. You come up through a war of independence. You come up through, which was particularly bloody, which people in Britain, or certainly leadership figures in Britain, see as a war of terrorism. You know, but then the Irish feel this is the only way we can fight, because they tried it in 1916 and having that whole, you know, out and out warfare, rebellion. And look, it was over within a week, a heroic week, a week of huge self-sacrifice, as Pearse had wanted, and the blood sacrifice he felt was needed to wake up the Irish people. He got that. And it did fuel a war of independence, but that war of independence, in order to be won, had to be fought in a completely different mentality. And perhaps that's something that the Irish people also understand deeply. They got the idea that it was... They got the idea that this was a completely okay format of warfare. This, if you say what governments would call terrorism, but what others call guerrilla warfare. And that's going to be something that divides people too, because in Ireland, I suppose, there's always been an understanding of smaller countries who've had to resort to this, because you can't take on an army that's much more powerful than you. That too creates a problem. Then Ireland gets its independence, but it gets its independence for 26 counties, and 6 are left what they would see as fending for themselves, because there is a Protestant majority who very definitely want to remain part of Britain, want to remain part of the Union, so to speak. But that means there's a very sizable Catholic population who, right up until that point, had been part of one overall island of Ireland that was under British rule, and all fighting together for their freedom. And that must have been a very dark time. If you were a Northern Irish nationalist at that time, I often wonder what it must have been like if you were that kind of family, that kind of person in the likes of the IRA, or even just sympathising and supporting with it, thinking, yeah, well, we're all on this island, and, you know, whether I'm in Fermanagh or Monaghan, and you've mates and you're over and back, and you're talking about politics and getting freedom and will it happen and so on. And then suddenly, oh, yeah, actually, the guys down the road, they're going to rule themselves, but here in Northern Ireland, you're staying as part of Britain. That must have been tough. There must have been a feeling of abandonment at that time. And of course, for many, like Michael Collins, they saw this as a stepping stone. You know, this was something, we'll get back to North, but, you know, let's get this bit first, then we can get it on a footing. And that maybe was a sense in the Republic of Ireland, as it became in later years, by 1949, that there was in the Republic this idea that we could still, you know, it's still our objective. And that's why Ireland has this articles in its constitution then, Articles 2 and 3, which lay claim to Northern Ireland, which of course greatly upsets unionists. And unionists have, it's not like they haven't suffered either from IRA violence and from violence in the past. And when we get to the 60s, there is huge human rights abuses still going on of Catholics in Northern Ireland, and huge problems. It is not being run as a proper state or even as a proper part of the UK. It's one of those weird things you look back on in history and think, how could you not see all of this problem developing? How could you not address this? But they didn't, and they allowed a lot of sectarianism, a lot of bigotry to go on. And that culminates in an IRA campaign that in Northern Ireland that is particularly brutal. Everything from the shootings to the killings of innocent people to a bombing campaign, ultimately, both in the UK and in Northern Ireland, that takes many innocent lives, children's lives, people who were never going to be combatants. This is a shift away from what might have been seen as in previous times, the shooting of a soldier or a security forces even. All of these were put in inverted commas, legitimate targets. Now anybody was becoming a legitimate target. Bombings could happen anywhere. Anybody could be a victim of it. That only deepens the divide in Northern Ireland over 30 years. And it's a bitter, bitter conflict as a result, with huge amounts of hurt and death. And people, you know, you talk about the numbers of death, there are 3,000 dead, and people sometimes say, well, you know, in terms of modern conflicts, it's not enough. A lot of people, it is in an island like Ireland, you know, where there just aren't the numbers. It was more a case of not having the numbers available to them to take the lives of, because otherwise they would have. This was a particularly brutal conflict. And then the amount of people who are injured, hurt, and casualties of that, the lives that are destroyed for something that increasingly is harder and harder to understand as the world outside of this conflict is globalizing all the time. And it becomes harder with the advance of the EU and everything else to understand what is really dividing these people so bitterly. But it's all of that. It's all of that being pushed in. That's your whistle stop of Irish history, as I say, not a historical account, but a context, because all of that is in the mindset. It's in the mindset of people, and you can't ignore it. Even if you agree with it or disagree with it, you have to accept that that's there. It's part of that mindset. And there are all these agreements. There's Sunningdale and an agreement which attempts to try and form its own self-governance in Northern Ireland. It collapses, and people on all sides are pretty much, you know, clapping when it collapses, because they all feel it's not what it could have been. There's the Anglo-Irish Agreement in the 80s, which does create some advances in particularly Irish-British relationships, but ultimately is no vehicle for agreement in Northern Ireland, because there is a tendency, and what does happen, going back to that point about, is it terrorism or is it a guerrilla warfare? Those kind of arguments. Of course, the more that the campaign seems to take innocent lives, the more people call it terrorism. The more it becomes just criminal. You have the hunger strikes, which, you know, if you want to go back to our election podcasts in the early 80s, you'll hear some of the coverage from that and some of the suffering endured on all sides during that period, which was particularly a bitter time. But that idea that, you know, this is just terrorism now, these are just gangs looking for control, and there's merit to that argument at times. Equally, there's merit to an argument that these are freedom fighters who are seeing this not as just something to gain power, but something where their very rights are being infringed. And if they want their kids to grow up in a different society, this is all that's open to them. That's their view. Those kind of challenges throughout the 80s make this particularly difficult. And it makes it particularly difficult to get agreement, even more so because governments, by their nature, in modern times, have moved to a point where it's always terrorism is not something you negotiate with. And therefore, while the British government would and did have contacts with the IRA at various times, it did have in the 70s, Gerry Adams has spoken about that extensively in the 70s. It also did right up, through the 90s and the peace process. John Major had contacts with them, and they created some debate between his contacts with the IRA and Albert Reynolds' contacts with the IRA. Whole other story there. But their contacts could happen very secretly. They would not tell anybody, in particular in Britain, about it. But obviously, a major world power like Britain at the time, with intelligence forces and so on, was part and parcel of contact with it or trying to infiltrate it at times, all of that kind of stuff. But ultimately, publicly, they did not talk to any of these groups. When it came to talking about peace, there was never a peace deal on offer where they were going to talk down and sit down and talk about an agreement with the likes of the IRA. And on the other side of it, Ulster Unionist paramilitaries felt they too were being pushed out and that they were the only last real line of defence against the IRA campaign. The evidence of collusion between security forces and loyalist paramilitaries, you had all kinds of horrific things going on. But ultimately agreements failed because they never really, they tried to deal with them as governments, as a just political problem of the modern age, when there was so much more to it and so much more feeling behind it. That changed dramatically in the early 90s as contacts were made, and they involved huge risks. They involved huge risks, in particular in the first instance by John Major and Albert Reynolds, who, you know, and again, we could spend a whole podcast on the Downing Street Declaration, but it was probably the most important document in hundreds of years in Anglo-Irish relations. It moved things on immeasurably. You could argue that the Good Friday Agreement was still really just a little bit more detailed form of the Downing Street Declaration that everybody signs up to, because it laid a foundation on very big matters like consent. It moved things on in a huge leap. After the Downing Street Declaration, there becomes an inevitability about having to have ceasefires, having to get round a table, having to have talks, and ultimately having a peace agreement. Now, I say inevitability in inverted commas. None of it was ever inevitable. It appears that way as you read it back, but it was never inevitable and could have been derailed and forgotten and become a footnote in history at any point. Only for great people on all sides taking huge risks. But those risks were manifold across the body politic, because you have in at the start of the Downing Street declarations, you have Albert Reynolds, who decides to really risk everything on this, because he reaches out through Father Alex Reid to the IRA and has these contacts. If at any point, and this seems bizarre to us now, but if at any point that had been known, it would have been a resigning matter in Ireland of that time. There were warnings going around that never ever do this, don't sit down. The opposition would have been hugely critical of what they would have seen as a naive man going out talking to terrorists. That was an enormous risk. There was huge brinkmanship, and of course that's where Reynolds' strength came into it. He was at times, and he's recounted it time and time again, where he says to the IRA, it's now or never. He says it about the same kind of brinkmanship when it comes to the Downing Street Declaration, where he pushes the IRA as far as they can possibly go. John Major, too, takes enormous risks because he has to move on issues that are really close to the idea of the union, something that the Conservative Party holds incredibly dearly. He has to take massive risks with his career on that. He does so and moves that enormously on. And John Major deserves eternal credit of the Irish people for how he pulled what was a very difficult Conservative Party that at the time relied on the Ulster Unionist votes in Parliament to keep the government in place. It was incredibly brave times and huge brinkmanship on him, when a British Prime Minister could have said, we have other world affairs to look at, other bigger issues to fry. I'm not going to have my career decided by this little bit of the union, which is Northern Ireland. And that's what many others did. He didn't. He actually put everything on the line for that. You were lucky you had a combination of people like Bill Clinton, who had a real care for Ireland, who gets involved. You have this whole St. Patrick's Day thing, and people tell you that Patrick's Day events don't matter. They matter. They matter a lot. And you need only read from Bill Clinton to Tony Blair to Bertie Ahern to Albert Reynolds and the various discussions that happened. Gerry Adams himself talking about what happens in the White House at that time on the St. Patrick's Day events that moved things forward immeasurably. And that was important. But there was a culmination of all those people. And eventually, you know, we get to ceasefires, agreements, but we need a peace agreement. And that starts, and it brings together a number of people. It brings together Tony Blair, who's got a different view. He's not reliant on unionists. He brings something really fresh from a British perspective to it. He's well supported, well liked in Britain. He has a firm hold on power, and he can push things through. He's also a very likeable guy in terms of his ability to negotiate and what he does and how he brings people along with him. Therefore, he's much more likely to get that kind of agreement. On the other hand, you have, after Robert Reynolds, you get John Bruton, who has the twin track approach, but goes through a turbulent time because ceasefires break down. But he keeps those channels open all the time with Britain, keeps plugging on at it, keeps the peace process alive at a time when it could have been completely derailed. And then Bertie Ahern takes over. And of course, Bertie Ahern, a bit like Tony Blair, is seen as a very likeable guy. He again has a lot of support as a leader. He's coming into this as, you know, being the acceptable face of, maybe if you like, a pan-nationalist front. He can be nationalist, but he can be quite relaxed about that nationalism. It's always to do with the vote and only the vote, and that's what matters. There's no guns, no bombs. But he's also the kind of guy who is a very strong, good negotiator, and he's renowned for that, and that's going to play a role in it. So when you get all of those people, and the US and Bill Clinton appoints George Mitchell, a very experienced US senator, to start having these discussions and in Northern Ireland and bringing people together. But just remember that one of the things that's so different about this time is that it starts with the Downing Street Declaration, and the Downing Street Declaration is important because it's the thing that opens the door to paramilitaries putting down their weapons. All previous kind of agreements were just gone with the acceptable political parties. And at the end of the day, if people are shooting each other, much as we may not like it, and much as we might have to hold our nose, we have to stop the people who have the guns actually shooting each other. These people came from a very different background. You had loyalist paramilitaries, and you had the IRA. And you had both of them knowing that if they get something wrong, we talk about the leaders John Major, Albert Reynolds, Tony Blair, Bertie Ahern, they would have paid an enormous political price for the guys who are in the paramilitaries, let's also be fair to them. They've got to get this right or they risk their actual lives. That's the world they operate in. And we can be very unsympathetic about it and say that's the life you choose. Get involved with paramilitaries, yada, yada. But that is what they're doing. There's brinkmanship here on a whole other level. And that's why they needed political leaders in governments who understood that, who understood the risks that were being taken here. If they fail, if they're seen as naive, they will not only be pushed aside, but your life can be under threat. People like David Irvine, people like Gerry Adams, Martin McGuinness, they really do put themselves out on a limb here. And they take enormous risks to keep people within, let's say, IRA or loyalist paramilitaries on board. And not everyone's going to remain on board, and they know that. And those who are what become later known as dissidents, they are a life threat to you from that day on. Because that's how bitter this conflict is. So all of those risks culminated in coming to an agreement, a Good Friday Agreement, as it was known in the Republic, the Belfast Agreement, as it was known to unionists. But it's an enormous difference. It's a changed culture where people feel, yes, we can move on. Yes, we can get agreement. And there's a lot of brinkmanship in those days, right throughout. I've whistle-stopped toured all through that, but there was nothing inevitable about it. There were rows, there were walkouts, there were problems, there were threats, there was lives lost during these times. And yet, it was all coming to one great culmination, which was the Good Friday Agreement and a referendum that would have to be held in the Republic of Ireland on this, because it's going to make constitutional change, in particular to what were called Articles 2 and 3, those articles that lay claim to Northern Ireland. Now, it's not all plain sailing, though, as you might expect, within a lot of the parties as to what they have to achieve within all of that history. So while I think there probably was a feeling that if we can get an agreement, people will back it. If there's an agreement, people must support it. Not always guaranteed. I mean, at home here in Ireland, you have different parties, different views. There has always been a division on the Northern question, if you like. The idea between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael has always been somewhat different, and they've always had a generally fairly unified bipartisan approach, was always kind of in there. Don't, you know, risk and be out and out opposition to each other. But they've had very different takes on the party and each party's approach to Northern Ireland. Their supporters always saw themselves as very, very different to it. You have in Fine Gael for many of those years a question that they would have been, in particular, they would have been the party that would have said there can be no discussion with terrorists. There can be no discussion with the IRA. They would have been completely opposed to any private talks with the IRA or with Sinn Féin at that time. They would have seen themselves as very much the party that holds a handout to unionists and wants to work in cooperation with unionists, that saw themselves very much as, you know, a more modern, if you like, take on Irishness, something that was leaving all that old republicanist traditions, if you like, a little bit behind. Not that they were forgetting it, they were still very proud of their history, but they were very much that things had moved on and they were more mature about this, if you like. On the other hand, you'd Fianna Fáil, who were still very much trying to cling to their republican credentials, very much still the party Conor Cruise O'Brien described as the party that had a sneaking respect for the IRA, and that among their supporters, you were more inclined to find the rebel ballads being sung, a little bit more tolerance of where the IRA had come from and what they were doing. It was more likely the Fianna Fáil were the party that was going to reach out there too. But Fianna Fáil would have been accused at the time of not really understanding unionists at all, and maybe not understanding British government or what was required for peace. So you have these kind of arguments within the parties as well that don't make it plain sailing, because Fianna Fáil is not going to walk away from that Republican tradition that it has and just suddenly become this new party all about just peace and just about the new ways of thinking based around agreement. They still want to cling to the ballads and all that history I described. It's still going to form part of their thinking. So that has to be got around. But equally, at home, these parties are trying to keep politics going. Governments have changed over these years of this peace process. And while the likes of the paramilitary organisations can continue on in their leaderships and their political wings' leaderships, there's a lot of different stuff happening in government where elections are happening and people are out. And, you know, Tony Blair, Bertie Ahern, they're facing their own challenges on international and on the home front. And Bertie Ahern in particular, he's at the time of the Good Friday Agreement, he's struggling with a lot of new revelations about payments politicians. It's the whole Ray Burke thing of what's happening and money to politicians and all of that kind of thing is kicking off at home. That's not you have a flood tribunal that's talking about, you know, evidence from people like James Gogarty. That's filling the headlines, and people are not all that impressed by this, understandably enough. And his coalition partners, the Progressive Democrats, getting a little bit nervy and antsy about what's actually happening at this tribunal. And you've other opposition parties doing what opposition parties need to do, which is turn up the pressure. So you've them ramping that up. Now, it gets to a point where, you know, there are particular tensions for the government, but it eases off. There is a bit of a lull. The Labour Party goes looking at a merger with Democratic Left, takes a bit of pressure off, takes a focus away from tribunals, and everybody's a little bit distracted by some other things. And as Stephen Collins says in his book, The Power Game, Fianna Fáil since Lammas, he points out that this lull offers Bertie Ahern the chance to focus on Northern Ireland. And he says, quote, "The lull gave Ahern the interlude he needed to concentrate on dealing with the increasing tempo of events in the north. At this stage, following the renewed IRA ceasefire, Sinn Féin had been admitted to talks involving all other northern parties and chaired by former US Senator George Mitchell. It was a complicated and difficult process which at times came close to collapse, but it ended triumphantly on Good Friday 1998 with the so-called Good Friday Agreement based on the principles of the Downing Street Declaration in 1993. Under its terms, an executive involving Sinn Féin was to be established in the north. Decommissioning of paramilitary weapons was to conclude by the 22nd of May 2000. Terrorist prisoners were to be released and a referendum held on both sides of the border to ratify the agreement. Part of the deal was that the territorial claim to the north in Articles 2 and 3 of the Irish Constitution would be abolished and replaced with provisions expressing an aspiration to unity. The agreement was a triumph of diplomacy, and while it was by no means plain sailing afterwards, it gave Ahern a standing that he had not had before. The amendment of Articles 2 and 3 of De Valera's constitution was a potential minefield for Ahern, but he skillfully steered the changes through his parliamentary party and got the endorsement of the Fianna Fáil National Executive." End quote. Now, there's a couple of points in that quote there that I think are important. And the final one he makes there about Ahern skillfully getting it through is because you would think that, well, sure, you've got this agreement, surely everyone agrees. There were elements in Fianna Fáil that were a little bit uneasy about giving up Articles 2 and 3, the claim on the North. That wasn't that something we had since De Valera, since the foundation of the party? That's Ireland, and we're not giving up on it. And it goes back to that sense, whether or not you believe that that was something that they just wanted, and it was just this vision of Ireland as this united state that they wanted to create, or whether you think that some do, that it was perhaps a little bit of a sense of guilt that they carried with them ever since, that was just to do with, yeah, we did abandon the North. And we said we'd get it back, and part of those articles 2 and 3 were a signpost to them that, you know, they are part of Ireland. Giving that up, well, you know, makes you feel like a little bit guilty on it. So there were feelings there that had to be overcome. I do remember too at the time, he says here about it being on the getting the Fianna Fáil National Executive to back it. And I served on the Fianna Fáil National Executive around these times. And there was a lot of discussion about these things. There was a lot of debate around senior people in the party about these things. And one of the things that always surprised me was how deeply felt it was within Ogra. Because I was very much, from the agreement came out, this is peace. This is peace, you know. This saves, we have to have a modern state here. We have to move on. We've got paramilitaries to agree to this. Then we have to agree to it too. And yet I would meet people, particularly in Ogra, Fianna Fáil at the time, who were kind of, I don't know, I need to take time to really consider this. And by the way, that's perfectly fine and fair to do. I, however, was surprised that they even needed the time to consider it, and were feeling dubious, and that we had to have these kind of town hall meetings here and there to discuss it and convince some people that this was the right thing to do. Now, you could argue maybe some people were just doing it for show, to, you know, show their Republican credentials, that this wasn't an easy decision for them. Maybe. But it certainly was there. Now, there were lots of other things, though, that were much more difficult in the Good Friday Agreement than just what was happening for Fianna Fáil. Because within paramilitary organisations, the idea of giving up the weapons becomes a huge thing. And in ratifying a treaty for those who are of a really strongly Republican view, that would seem like a really major price to pay. Because if you have to not just lay down your weapons, there was this thing in Republican circles of a pike in the thatch. It was something that was there when you needed it, and, you know, you'd pull it down, and that was that old revolutionary spirit. There's something different about what's then called the decommissioning of weapons. There's something different about not just laying down your weapon, but handing it over to someone to be destroyed. There's something about that becomes easy to pitch as surrender. And they definitely had to avoid that. And that was a major risk for those who were on either side of the paramilitary divide, whether you're unionist or you're in the IRA, INLA, any of these organisations. The idea of that was going to be a tough sell. On the other hand, for many of the people involved in, let's say, democratic political parties, as they were known at the time, or the normal mainstream of politics, particularly in Northern Ireland, in there you will see Stephen Collins mentions the release of Republican prisoners. And that's going to, and that causes issues for a long time to come. In this, because people have to take that on. For many people who were victims, and there are a lot of victims of violence on both sides of the conflict in Northern Ireland, a lot of hurt. The idea that many of these people who are associated with the Troubles, Republican prisoners, that in particular the greater number, are going to be released, that anybody who has committed a crime, somebody who has murdered your loved one, somebody who has attacked, and you will see it struggles in the Republic of Ireland when it comes to people who, killers of Gardaí being released. These things begin to really hurt people, and people begin to question, is it right? Were they really fighting a war? Were they really... But we're letting them out. That was a really bitter pill and a tough one to get through in a referendum, that we are going to let some of these people out. And when some of them come out, there's going to be celebrations in their own circles, in their own communities, for the people who really see them as fighters for one side or other. they're going to celebrate that. You're going to have to watch that celebration and them get on with their lives, even though they've taken the life of someone you know, or destroyed a life of someone you know by leaving them an invalid for life, or you know, these kind of feelings are very close to the surface. And we sometimes forget and think that all of this was just a technicality. It was far from it, and far from it because you could not get people to really back an agreement like this unless they felt that the payoff was going to be huge. And that was why Northern Ireland, being seen as a real, this was a foundation of long lasting peace, and there were prices to be paid by every side for that peace. That's where that's the only thing that could convince people to go with it. But it was internationally important. I mean, Bill Clinton once said in later years that, you know, when he talked to people in the Middle East and he talked about conflicts there, he say, you know, look, you get this conflicts and how it started since, you know, the 1950s and 60s. And he said, you know, these are long and bitter conflicts in the likes of the Middle East. He said, but, you know, if we can go to the Middle East and say, look at what we did in Northern Ireland, then we can build something. Then you can build trust. Then right round the world, people can say, if that conflict that is hundreds of years of argument and debate there, if that can be solved, surely we can solve any of the others. And he made that point. He also, in his book, his biography, My Life, Bill Clinton talks about how he felt when the agreement was reached. And he says, quote, "Good Friday, April 10th, was one of the happiest days of my presidency. 17 hours past the deadline for a decision, all the parties in Northern Ireland agreed to a plan to end 30 years of sectarian violence. I had been up most of the night before trying to help George Mitchell close the deal. Besides George, I talked to Bertie Ahern and to Tony Blair, David Trimble and Gerry Adams twice before going to bed at 2:30 a.m. At 5, George woke me with a request to call Adams again to seal the deal. The agreement was a fine piece of work, calling for majority rule and minority rights, shared political decision-making and shared economic benefits, continued ties to the United Kingdom and new ties to Ireland. The process that produced the pact began with the determination of John Major and Albert Reynolds to seek peace, continued when John Bruton succeeded Reynolds, and was completed by Bertie Ahern, Tony Blair, David Trimble, John Hume and Gerry Adams. My first visa to Adams and the subsequent intense engagement of the White House made a difference, and George Mitchell handled the negotiations brilliantly. Of course, the main credit went to those who had to make the hard decisions, the Northern Ireland Irish leaders, Blair and Ahern, and the people of Northern Ireland, who had chosen the promise of peace over a poisoned past. The agreement would have to be ratified in a referendum by the voters of Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic on May 22nd. With a touch of Irish eloquence, it became known as the Good Friday Accord." End quote. That's Bill Clinton from his biography, My Life. And I think, you know, it is important. It is important in world terms. This was really world news and the eyes of the world on this little island. Because when you get a US president saying, one of the happiest and most important days of my presidency was when this was delivered, and the involvement of the US in that was huge. It also allowed for the US, this was important for the US, because as I said earlier, Clinton talked about, you know, how that meant for the Middle East. It's one of the few instances where the US actually proved that it could use a different type of influence in world politics, where it could come to a country like Ireland and be trusted by the British government, the Irish government, and the paramilitaries could respect it. And the US could make something happen and facilitate something without guns, bombs, and soldiers on the ground. And in a time when the US was becoming seen as almost this world police force, where intervention was happening, in military intervention increased more and more and would increase more and more in the decades after, there was a brief glimmer there where it looked like, you know, there's a different path here for the likes of the power the US diplomacy can bring. they played a crucial role in facilitating that. Now, crucially, it was slightly different that all the countries were agreed and respected the US, and the US was not seen as the enemy of any particular part in it. But that in itself tells a story. Everywhere else the US tried to get involved, in so many areas, it was either the enemy itself or it needed to back it up with military might, only perpetuating this feeling that they were an enemy of somebody's. In Northern Ireland, they had that brief glimmer that looked like the US could be and should be something different in how it presented itself to the world as that facilitator, as that real beacon of diplomacy and hope between nations. And I think, to be fair, the US deserves a huge amount of credit, in particular Bill Clinton, for that and the role played in that. But it does also suggest that Northern Ireland was worldwide news. It was one of the most important achievements and diplomatic achievements of the time to have reached that. And that's where the referendum comes from. That feeling, that elation, that sense of this has really happening. We've got an agreement and there are bitter pills to swallow. But what was being held out was that for all those bitter pills that might be within there, for all those things you might be giving up that you've carried with you as baggage, this agreement offers you a chance to put that poisoned past, as Clinton calls it, behind you. This affords us all an opportunity to build a whole new country, community, a sense of that is the past and the future is something else. And it was that was the thing that I think people reacted to. But when we look at it today, that's why it becomes so, people get so protective of the Good Friday Agreement in the Brexit context, because they think, hold on, this was something promised, something very, very different for everybody. Huge sacrifices were made to make this happen and huge things were put aside and, you know, compartmentalized by people to allow it to happen. You can't just row back in and go, and by the way, we'll rub out this bit of the Good Friday Agreement or that bit of it over here, without reopening huge, huge old wounds and people saying the promise you gave us is not the promise we've now received. Now, to give you a sense of maybe some of the debate that was happening, is an interesting article in the Irish News by John Manley, which was penned on the 20th anniversary of the referendum. But he gives a useful summary of some of the things that were in the debate, how the sides lined up, if you like, when it comes to the Good Friday Agreement at referendum, or Belfast Agreement in the North, as I say. I have to correct myself there, but being from the Republic, that's what we know it as, so it's how I'm going to refer to it probably throughout. John Manley in the Irish News article, he says, quote, "Nationalism broadly supported the agreement, though the support of Sinn Féin and the IRA was qualified, and Republicans didn't actively campaign for a yes vote. The SDLP leader, Seamus Mallon, was characteristically scathing of what he saw as the Republican movement's fence-sitting. You can't have one toe in the water and one toe out. Sinn Féin's erstwhile comrades and Republican Sinn Féin urged the electorate to reject the agreement, as did the 32 Sovereignty Committee. Voting yes on May 22nd will not save us from more Drumcrees or more Harryvilles," said RSF leader Rory O'Brody. While the Ulster Unionist Party had played a key role in securing the agreement weeks earlier, its support came at a price. There were defections, Arlene Foster and Geoffrey Donaldson among the most high profile, and internal dissent best manifested by MPs Willie Ross and William Thompson. Spearheading the no campaign were DUP leader Ian Paisley and his deputy Peter Robinson, alongside UK Unionist leader Bob McCartney and serial protester Cedric Wilson. Mr. McCartney had been dismissive of the agreement, describing it as an effort to buy off the IRA, not produce peace. Former UUP leader Jim Mullineaux also opposed the peace accord. During the campaign, a schism that had opened between the DUP and loyalism became more pronounced. These two wings of unionism, Christian fundamentalism and working class, largely secular paramilitaries, were ostensibly incompatible, but had been strange bedfellows for much of the Troubles. Their respective takes on the agreement, however, brought their differences to the surface, and for a short while the DUP and the organisations under the combined Loyalist Military Command banner were bitter adversaries, with the latter siding with nationalism and liberal unionism by vociferously backing the agreement. Notorious UDA killer Michael Stone, recently released from prison, publicly supported the agreement at a rally in the Ulster Hall a week before polling day. The Yes campaign also received the endorsement of relatives of victims from the Shankill bomb and the father of Paul Maxwell, a 15-year-old murdered by the IRA in County Sligo, as it targeted Lord Louis Mountbatten. However, not all victims of the previous three decades of violence were convinced by the agreement, and especially that element that saw prisoners released early. Rosemary Craig, whose RUC officer husband had been badly wounded in an IRA attack, was among those campaigning for no. It was the early prisoner releases that almost dealt the Yes campaign a fatal blow, as the release of Milltown Cemetery killer Stone and the IRA's Balcombe Street gang appeared to turn public opinion against the agreement in the days before the poll. Yes campaign director in Northern Ireland, Quinton Oliver, recalls that many organisations were reticent in voicing support for this campaign. There was quite a few organisations, including in churches and some business bodies, that wouldn't commit corporately because they had so many of their members would dissent, he said. In the end, the intervention of international statesmen, including Bill Clinton and Nelson Mandela, alongside celebrity endorsements from the likes of Bono and Kenneth Branagh, helped buoy the pro-agreement campaign, end quote. Now, that's from John Manley looking back at the referendum in the Irish news. And as you see there, it's focused on Northern Ireland, where the referendum was also taking place. But it's an important article, and the reason I want to quote it, well, maybe it's not about the referendum in the Republic. That's where real debate was happening, and it did influence people. People were watching closely, because ultimately this affected Northern Ireland, and while in the Republic there was broad nationalism and wanting to be nationalist, still was a sense they would be guided by what was there in the North. And you have this bizarre situation where the combined Loyalist military command, the Loyalist paramilitaries, are now in a more reasonable, if you like, position than Ian Paisley. You have the Ulster Unionist Party, who have brought about this agreement with the likes of David Trimble in there. And, you know, they're losing people like Arlene Foster over this. This is really problematic for the parties. It's something that, you know, as we watch Northern Ireland, it starts to convulse that debate. Now, it's buoyed up. The Yes campaign is still strong there. It's in it, but it's always held together by that promise that this is all worth it. You can see there how the victims were struggling with this and the idea of whether or not it was okay to support it. You can see how some people saw it as surrender to the British, and then other people saw it the British surrendering to the IRA. And those arguments were tossed out time and time again. It was a very difficult process mentally for people to go through and try to process what was happening here. And the only thing was that it held out an offer of a very different world, a world where peace was going to be upheld, where there was opportunity, where we're not going to have borders, where there was going to be a reopening of society and less oppressive rules and an acceptance of differences, all those things. That became the hope, and that's why it's still so valid today, because it was built on those parameters. And you can see where, you know, in that article, some of the political voices and how it's changed. I mean, for a while, it seems some of the likes of the Republican Sinn Féin, Rory O'Brady, that they were being sidelined by this because there was a huge support. But that huge support and a huge amount of credit has to go to where Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness were able to pull that support right across the island of Ireland to back this agreement. Without them, that couldn't have happened. And no matter what anybody says, that has to be noted. Yes, you can go back and you can talk about there are links to terrorism, but on all sides. Equally, the Loyalist paramilitaries, people like David Irvine, incredibly important to this process because they bring people with them. They bring the respect of these are people who put their lives on the line for this. you may disagree with them, but ultimately, without them, you couldn't have had that peace. And that is important to note. Now, when it comes to the referendum itself, it's interesting also to note that one of the outcomes of it is that the Ulster Unionist Party will, over time, fall way behind the Democratic Unionist Party. And by the time it comes to actual government and power sharing, the first real government that's going to be formed there, the first real sense is going to be Ian Paisley, who is opposed to this at the point of the referendum. And he's going to be leader along with Martin McGuinness, and they're going to sit down and they're going to start this new era together. And it is a strange, strange thing that the strength of the DUP begins to suck in members of the UUP. They undermine the UUP on things like this very agreement, and they will assume power after that. You are also see there Seamus Mallum of the SDLP and his frustrations with the paramilitaries, in that he's annoyed. He's saying you can't have one toe in and one toe out of the water, which is what he sees when he sees Republicans in Sinn Féin saying, well, we're not going to canvass for this either way, we're just going to let it out there. And it's kind of like, that's hedging your bets. And he wants them to kind of get out there and just get backing it. That kind of frustration is understandable, and yet understandable on the other side, that the pressures within the Republican movement were enormous at this point in terms of trying to get this over the line. And one wrong word and you can send people en masse in the opposite direction. But you can see that frustration. And yet over the coming years, it is Sinn Féin that will grow and grow in power and influence after this. And the SDLP, having worked that role for so long of been trying to broker peace, having been essential to bringing people in, are going to drift away in terms of influence in Northern Ireland. Still there, but struggling to get back against a dominant Sinn Féin in there. So you start to see that some of the people who didn't campaign it managed to hold things together or benefit from it, even though they eventually get the referendum through and will benefit from the fact that the referendum goes through. You could even argue, although it's down more in the Republic of Ireland, one of the difficulties you also see, and one, I don't want to overplay this, but, you know, it is one line of thought that political scientists have put out too, that in the Republic, Fianna Fáil, this is the culmination of perhaps one of their greatest ever achievements, really, that they could lay claim to through Reynolds and Ahern as being really a Fianna Fáil achievement here. It's something they can really claim. And yes, people like John Brute and Gareth Fitzgerald contributed along the way, but it's really something Fianna Fáil can lay claim to and will lay claim to in that political sense. But here's the difficulty. For that Fianna Fáil party, for that party, where do you go after something that some would argue the Fianna Fáil has defined itself as being that little bit more nationalist, as being sound on the national question, as being this huge sense of Irishness, and that after the Good Friday Agreement, Fianna Fáil fails to really identify itself in this new world, and that part of its drift in power, now, again, I don't want to overplay it because I think there were many elements to that, but that of what should have been its greatest achievement, it starts its own downward trend in relevance and in being different to Fine Gael and how it defines itself as being different, and in some ways becomes a little bit more like Fine Gael for some. And ultimately, of course, now there were a lot other reasons for Fianna Fáil's demise in the last decade, but you could argue, if you wanted again, that you look at the rise of Sinn Féin over that time. Fianna Fáil don't handle that rise well. They fail to see the opportunities for them in where Sinn Féin are at and in that new formation of politics. And they do end up going a little bit closer to Fine Gael over the years by being threatened by Sinn Féin. And ultimately, nowadays, seem to be struggling to outpoll Sinn Féin. Whether or not that lasts, we don't know, but that's where people would say it's at. So many of the main players who are here in this fail to get that real backing. I mean, the Labour Party, Tony Blair, look, he's going to have much bigger issues after the Iraq War. You know, Does it save people? It's questionable. And that's maybe where people would have gone back to in earlier decades and said, Northern Ireland, you can achieve great legacies. Will it save your political career? Probably not. Most of the people who took the big risks for this did not get some of the big benefits for it. But ultimately, the referendum kicks off with a lot of impassioned debate around these issues, whether it's from the decommissioning weapons to the early release of prisoners. And around Irish people are watching that closely because they're watching to see, is it right? Is it the right thing to do? But in terms of the information that has to be given out to people, as we mentioned in previous referendums, Ireland has this new thing now because of various court decisions of the Referendum Commission, who give, when we're using government money, you have to use it in a fair and impartial way. And the Referendum Commission has, over these early referendums, been finding its feet, finding the best way to present arguments and items for discussion and what they will mean. And it's just interesting to go back to this one because there was so much debate about, you know, how do you present information. The referendum on Northern Ireland, Referendum Commission produces a leaflet. It simply says, the referendum on Northern Ireland, your time to decide. And thanks to Alan Kinsella at ElectionLit on Twitter for sending this on to me. But it just gives arguments for and against. And it lays it out quite simply like that. I'm just going to read a little bit of the opening for you. It says, quote, on the 10th of April 1998, agreement was reached in Belfast by all participants in the multi-party negotiations on a range of matters covering relationships within Northern Ireland, between North and South, and between the two islands. In the context of this multi-party agreement, the Irish government undertook to propose and support changes in the Constitution of Ireland. The proposed changes are an essential element in the multi-party agreement and a precondition for the entry into force of the British-Irish agreement. On the 22nd of May, you will be asked to vote yes or no to these proposals. You will already have received a booklet explaining the details of the proposals. For your convenience, these are summarised below under Summary of the Proposed Changes. This leaflet also contains the statements for and against acceptance of the proposed changes to the Constitution. The statements in this leaflet have been prepared and published by the Referendum Commission. The Commission is an independent statutory body established under the Referendum Act 1998. The Commission advertised in the national and local press seeking submissions from the public on the merits of the proposed amendments to the Constitution. Having regard to the submissions received, the statements represent the arguments for and against acceptance of the proposed changes to the Constitution. There is no significance to the order in which the individual arguments are presented. The Commission cannot express a view on the comparative merits or demerits of the arguments. That will be a matter for you to consider when voting on Friday the 22nd of May. End quote. And I just think that's an interesting context because here I think there's a subplot of the Referendum Commission finding its way and how it's going to position itself, particularly on issues like this, where there seems to be, you know, on one level broad agreement, but they're sensitive. And here what they've decided to do is put out an advert in the national media saying, please give us your views on these. And obviously people give views for and against, and then they take these and they try to summarise them and come to what are real strong arguments, but they can't talk about the merits. This can be confusing. And people will always say in referendums, just tell us, what are the facts? We want to know, is this right, is that right? This becomes the ultimate difficulty for a body like the Referendum Commission. How do you give people the arguments? How do you give them information on either side and still stick to facts? Because, you know, other people will say, well, that's not entirely true, or it is. And it's sometimes there are these grey areas within it. Just to tell you how they put it here, they say the case for they present first, and that says, quote, the conflict in Northern Ireland has resulted in the deaths of thousands of people and has blighted the lives of many on these islands. The compelling argument for voting yes is that these agreements, the products of inclusive negotiations, represent a real opportunity for peace and a just society in Northern Ireland and for peaceful relations between both parts of the island. This opportunity should be grasped. This is the dominant consideration in every issue arising in the referendum.
All of the proposed amendments are conditional upon the legislative measures specified in the British-Irish Agreement being put in place. Thus, if for any reason such a no vote in Northern Ireland, these measures are not implemented, the proposed amendments to the Irish Constitution will not take effect. This ensures that no changes to the Irish Constitution will take effect unless preceded by corresponding changes in Britain and Northern Ireland. The multi-party agreement provides for a fair accommodation between nationalists and unionists and provides a balanced constitutional settlement involving constitutional change in Britain, Northern Ireland and Ireland. It also provides for new institutional arrangements for internal government in Northern Ireland, operating on the basis of partnership and agreement between the two main communities. Major advances in equal treatment in the area of politics, economics, in social and language policies, and in the protection of human rights are also provided for. Sovereignty will be defined not in terms of territory, but in terms of people. This reflects the principle that it is the people who are sovereign. The proposed wording of Articles 2 and 3 embraces all peoples on the island, taking into account diverse traditions, identities and political affiliations. The proposed changes involve putting into the Constitution the principle which Ireland has already quite rightly accepted, that unity can only be achieved with the consent of the people of Northern Ireland. That same principle of consent is accepted by the British government, who have agreed that in the event of a majority of people in Northern Ireland favouring unity, it will take the necessary steps to give effect to that decision. So the British government and the people will not stand in the way of a united Ireland if that is agreed by the Irish people. This improves the prospects for Irish unity. The proposed amendment to Article 29 allows the state to be bound by the British-Irish Agreement. It will give a legal basis to the implementation of appropriate structures for cross-border cooperation. This cooperation will be carried out by cross-border bodies, which will have certain executive powers, but they will be implementing policies agreed by the Oireachtas and the Northern Ireland Assembly. Any extension of their powers will be subject to the endorsement of the Oireachtas. The North-South bodies will provide an opportunity for the two administrations to work together for the benefit of all the people of the island. This will have clearly defined areas of responsibility, and these can be extended by agreement. End quote.
Now you see, that's the referendum commission saying, right, here's the reasons you vote yes. And you get a sense of them. There are everything from, you know, there's all these bodies coming in, they're North-South bodies, you're getting the idea of sovereignty when saying to people, look, you've already agreed that it is the people who are sovereign, you've already agreed there has to be consent, you know, it's not that big a deal to just putting it in writing. And by the way, you're not taking any risk here, because if it's not agreed in the North, it's not agreed down here then. And if, you know, that there are corresponding ideas that this could help Irish unity by the British saying, well, if everybody votes for it, then you can have Irish unity, yes. And that's an important principle. So it lays out the benefits. Now, on the other side of the document, it moves into the arguments against. And it's interesting to see documents laid out like this and having to make both sides of an argument in a way that perhaps we don't often get to see, or we don't often get to see in terms of exactly how they lay them out anymore. But in any event, here is the case against, as written by the referendum commission in this referendum. And it says, quote, "You should vote no because the proposed changes enshrine partition in the Irish Constitution and surrender our claim to Northern Ireland. These radical changes are not justified by the terms of the multi-party agreement because that agreement does not sufficiently enhance the rights of nationalist citizens in Northern Ireland. The referendum is not a vote on the desirability of peace, and a no vote is not a vote for violence or against peace. Because of the form of the proposed amendments, it is the government, by a declaration, and not the people, by way of a further referendum, who have a final say in whether or not amendments take effect. This is inconsistent with the people's role in amending the Constitution. The absence of an absolute time limit for implementation makes this even more objectionable. Even if the changes come into effect, the structures and arrangements set out in the multi-party agreement may subsequently break down.
There is no provision for undoing the constitutional changes other than by a further referendum, and we would have made major concessions with no practical benefit to anyone. The provision of the multi-party agreement that it would be wrong to make a change in the status of Northern Ireland, save by a majority of its people, may be construed as requiring a majority of those entitled to vote, not just of those actually voting, an impossible result to achieve in Northern Ireland. There is no evidence that Articles 2 and 3 contributed in any way to the violence in Northern Ireland. If any changes in these articles were considered necessary, they should have been confined to a declaration that the existing claim would only be pursued by peaceful means. The changes will leave the national territory undefined. It is not possible to have a nation without a defined territory. The sense of Irish identity may be lost, particularly by people living in Northern Ireland. The change may also affect future claims in relation to oil, fisheries, or other natural resources. There is no obligation on either government to work towards a united Ireland. The constitutional obligation on the Irish government to pursue unification will be removed. The new Article 2 will give a constitutional right of citizenship to anyone born in Ireland. This will make it very difficult to change laws on citizenship, and it may prevent the enactment of necessary laws to regulate immigration. The North-South bodies provided for in the multi-party agreement are made possible by the proposed changes to Article 29, will not be elected or be accountable to the people. Their areas of responsibility are vaguely defined, and in the event that any dispute arises about their operation, it is unclear who will be responsible for resolving such disputes. The execution and operation of these North-South bodies will inevitably involve transfer of sovereignty from the Irish government. The acceptance by the government of the British-Irish Agreement under this article would effectively confer on unionists a veto on a united Ireland, so long as they are a majority in Northern Ireland. End quote. And you can see the difficulty for a body like the Referendum Commission there. There's something a little bit more emotive about those no arguments. People would debate several points as to whether they're true or false, some of the claims there, or whether they're real or imagined. Other things that I've said there clearly never came to pass and never were a risk, yet they're there in black and white from your referendum commission, and there equally you could be said the same things on the yes side. That's the real tightrope they're walking here, trying to produce information for people, trying to give them this balanced view. And it's a real challenge, and it's one that we're going to see evolving as referendum commission operates over further referendums in the future. But an interesting one just to see how that is there, just this for and against arguments. And you know, some people would be critical of it, and some people say they find it confusing, and some people say they find just the way it's written helps one side more than another. It's a very difficult, because it's such a tightrope for them. Now, on the other hand, you have Fine Gael, who simply produced an argument with some children on the front of it, you know, happily looking at a book, and it just says peace and harmony, and they are free, of course, to make their arguments for it. They say, they have a leaflet here, another one here from John Cushnahan, MEP, and he says, quote, on Friday the 22nd of May, vote yes to peace. By voting yes to the new Northern Agreement on the 22nd of May, you will be supporting an agreement to greater cross-border cooperation between the people of Ireland, a guarantee of equality of esteem and a peaceful coexistence between the two communities in Northern Ireland. New government structures for cooperation between the people of Ireland and the people of Britain for our mutual benefit. Vote yes to the Northern Agreement, and you will be putting peace first by providing a way forward for both communities in Northern Ireland. End quote. Now, that, and of course, this all, by the way, does take place at the same day as the Amsterdam Treaty, which we mentioned before, as being an important EU treaty, a subject of a previous podcast. But that's where you get this sense again, you know, this it's voting for peace, you're voting for coexistence. Who can be against this? And it goes back to that old thing Albert Reynolds started out with, who's afraid of peace? What are you afraid of? You know, What's wrong with having coexistence between people? There was also support on these issues from the likes of the Labour Party, who had their own leaflet. And it says, it talks a little bit about their own history in this. It's entitled Labour's Contribution to Peace. And it says, quote, Labour's commitment to peace has always been total. Throughout the years, Dick Spring in particular has played a crucial role in peacemaking. As a party, we have contributed to key developments and brought about the ceasefires and the first real possibilities of lasting peace. Labour helped to negotiate the Anglo-Irish Agreement in 1985, draft the Downing Street Declaration, mobilise international support, negotiate the framework document. Against this background, Labour fully supports the Good Friday Agreement, and we believe that it holds out for the first time a real prospect of lasting, durable agreement. The strategy which has underpinned the peace process over the past number of years can be summarised as follows. It has been aimed at removing violence from the conflict within Northern Ireland. It has attempted to build political structures to deal with the issues which lie at the heart of the conflict, and it has worked to enable the process of reconciliation to begin so that communities, families and individuals can learn to live and work together. End quote. Just an interesting take on it there from how Labour looked at it about aligning themselves as being this party of key architects of all this as they see it, and then some of those pillars just being identified for the public as well. Into all of that, so you have that broad political support, that broad mass of people backing it. You get a sense that, you know, there was a move that if we didn't back this, what were you going back to? It was hard enough to get an agreement, and people saw how torturous the negotiations were to get an agreement. If you reject this, there's not really an alternative out there. And yeah, you can say, oh, vote for no is not a vote for violence, it's a vote for changing things better. But people can't see really any alternative here. There's not like, well, if you don't accept this, we just continue with the talks again. They might just go nowhere. People could give up. The governments could give up. There is a sense that, you know, you go back to a spiral where there's you're not holding out enough reason for people to actually turn away from violence. And that is, of course, problematic in any society, particularly one where violence has been so prevalent over the previous 30 years. There was, of course, the agreement going in Northern Ireland. Now, in Northern Ireland, they hold the referendum, and yes, they get a huge turnout of more than 81% of people, and they vote in favour of the agreement. And you know, it's one of those where the changes to it, there's a little bit more debate and conflict in Northern Ireland, but they agree to it. On the same time, in the Republic, they're voting, and their vote is a little bit, you know, the turnout is it perhaps a little bit maybe disappointing for something so momentous. And given that there were two referendums on the day, Amsterdam and this, and it shows just how difficult it may be to get a lot of people. Because a turnout comes in at about 56.2% here. That's not, it's not a bad turnout. It's probably, you know, decent for referendums. But for something that was really part of such history, for something that we've talked about at the start of this podcast, that was seen for many as a culmination, it's clearly seen by over 40% of the population to be pretty much irrelevant to them. They don't care. Or if they do care, they don't want to make a decision on it. And they're staying away. And you could argue that maybe some people did stay away rather than vote outright no. But it's hard to justify it. It's hard to justify 40% of people not actually being interested in a vote like this. Even if they weren't interested in the Amsterdam Treaty, surely this would be. But then you can explain it away and say, look, they weren't interested in Amsterdam, and they kind of could see from polls it was a foregone conclusion on Northern Ireland.
Not everybody believes that part of history and want to be able to tell their grandkids that they went down to the polling station and voted yes in the Good Friday Agreement. They're not driven by that. They are just kind of saying, look, why would I bother? It's going to go through. It's fine. We'll all be there after. And I'm not going to put myself out on the day by having to go all the way down and vote on something that my one vote's not going to change clearly anyway. So, look, we do have to accept people have different priorities in it, but it is perhaps a little bit surprising in terms of turnout. On the other hand, it is an overwhelming result in it. Of the yes votes, there are nearly 1,932,632 votes in favour, which is 61.74% in terms of the referendum. These kind of figures are important because when we look at referendums and we look at what, you know, is the support for them, it's important to understand I'm getting myself confused here, so I'm just going to go back on that because I'm talking about the referendums was on the same day as the Amsterdam Treaty. So you have that turnout of 56.2% in both referendums. There's a small, slightly higher piece in the couple more people voted in the Good Friday Agreement, but not much. You're talking 0.01%. But you get a yes vote in the Amsterdam Treaty, which we've covered before, that's 61.74%. Now, just to compare that to the vote on the Good Friday Agreement, which comes in at 1,442,583, or 94.39% in agreement. So it's interesting because when you have the two referendums on the day in the Republic, you can see that how people are able to, because I would often criticise and say it's difficult when you have two referendums on one day. People get confused. It's too much to take on. But here you saw a really clear decision where, you know, 60% of people are in favour of Amsterdam. But, you know, you get, on the other hand, over 94% of people in agreement on the Northern Ireland agreement. So people clearly are making decisions and they clearly are going out there and want to be part of it and want to be part of that decision-making process. But it is a fascinating look at why. I mean, the amount of votes, there is only, you know, half the amount of spoiled votes. I mean, spoiled votes were very small, neither 2% and 1%, 33,000 spoiled votes in Amsterdam, 17,000 in the Northern Ireland referendum. These kind of figures point to an electorate that is thinking about it and is hugely backing and giving a ringing endorsement to that that result. And it's one of those times where there's almost a celebratory mood, even if so many people have decided not to be involved in the debate, not to go out and vote. But there's an overwhelming, it's a ringing endorsement of the idea of peace and that people want to see it happen, of those who go out to vote. And there is a sense of history about it, and it does pave the way for something very, very different. In the years that follow, it becomes the implementation of that Good Friday Agreement. And I don't think Irish people in the Republic see a huge difference in their lives. You know, Articles 2 and 3 were never something that you want to think about on a daily basis or anything. The cross-border bodies, gradually these things start to happen and be formed. Gradually we start seeing peace dividend, if you like, in the north. You begin to see the development of just that cross-border trade. Ireland as the Celtic Tiger, times move on, really gets that peace dividend too in the Republic, of cross-border trade, of new sense, new beginning. It was a bright, hopeful time for the island of Ireland and a very confident time that, you know, this had been achieved. All will change in terms of politics. It allows our other parties, particularly Sinn Féin, to grow in its strength in Northern Ireland, to become in from the cold. And that's been quite a dramatic journey from the time that, in the late 80s to very early 90s, you know, it was only in under the Reynolds Spring administration that Sinn Féin didn't need to have an actor's voice when one of them appeared on the radio, that it was when you saw Gerry Adams and Sally. It says only the early 90s that the government decides to lift the ban on having people from Sinn Féin. It says you could actually hear their voice, and people were like, wow, get to hear what Gerry Adams actually sounds like, because you'd always heard actors' voices. It's amazing. In that journey, in those few years, it's been rapid and it's been quick and will continue being so. Now, Sinn Féin have their own wobbles as it goes, as they struggle to sometimes break into major politics and break. That changes in very recent times, which we'll deal with in other elections, or you can go back to our election podcast to look at some of that. But the Good Friday Agreement is an essential part of Irish history, because it does bring certainly a chapter to a close. And what it certainly does is it allows a generation of Irish people grow up who will not see conflict on the island, who all of this becomes very quickly a dark memory, and perhaps an idea that something, you know, that's a past we can forget. But of course, we shouldn't forget it. And we should always remember that it's still very close to us. It's still within touching distance of us to ever dip back into it, because it was only the promise that it held out that allowed such a vote to come in and to give such an endorsement to it. And very small things can tip that balance again. And so we draw to a close on what I think is an important referendum. If it wasn't one of those fiery referendums, fair enough. But it was one that was momentous, that will live long in Irish history. It was a time when the Heaney poem was quoted of "Let hope and history rhyme." And all of that sense in Ireland is, at this point, it's part of the new confidence that comes with it, that if we could solve this, if we could get beyond it. And it's part of an Ireland that changes radically in the years ahead. But it reminds us of a number of very important lessons that come with that referendum and the process that led to it. First and foremost, that achievements take risks, huge risks. And for some people who take the risks will not pay off for them. But some things are worth it. Some things are worth it because they are about saving lives or making people's lives immeasurably better and changing things in history forever. It takes a risk. It takes putting yourself out there. It takes huge toil and effort in negotiations. But even if you don't personally get the accolades for it, it can be worth it to just see the history take place. And the second thing it reminds us of is that we can't take for granted and assume that these things would always happen, because there were many efforts at peace, there were many efforts at talking, and just sitting down and talking and just taking the risk is not enough to deliver. It takes many people. It takes a culmination at the right time, the right mood, and the right people at every step of the way. And we do owe a debt of gratitude to people who come together to actually deliver these things. It is only, as I say, touching distance away in our history that such violence was a normal part of everyday society. It gets to a point where I think we get so comfortable in a democratic society that everything is going to be fine and everything's going to be good. We get to believing that it always will be, and maybe it won't always be. And that's something I think we have to guard very jealously. So that's it for this week. That's it from the Good Friday Agreement. We will be back with more referendums shortly. We will also be back at the end of the month with our news roundup, which we are going to do at the end of March, looking at the big stories of the time. Thank you for listening. Thank you for any of your comments over recent times on Twitter and on Facebook. Please give the podcast a share. Let people know it's out there. If you know of anybody that might be interested, give them a mention. Tell them a little bit about it and spread the word. We'll be delighted to have any new listeners along the way. And in addition, I want to thank again my colleagues at Carr Communications who make this podcast possible, and also to people like Alan Kinsella at Electionalist on Twitter for his contribution with his wonderful collection of referendum materials. In the meantime, take care. As I say, we will be back with more referendum issues in the coming weeks, and in particular, looking at some of the big referendums that came and in the early 2000s in particular. We have a number of really interesting ones to look at as well. So do stay tuned for that. In the meantime, stay safe, and we'll chat again soon.